welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan, and I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg. And this week on the show, well, the attention of global investors has once again returned to China. But this time, it wasn't because of the trade tensions with the U.S. Rather, it was China's own domestic crackdown on the for-profit education industry, spooking investors to the tune of a more than 10% drop in the MSCI China Index in just 2 days. It was so shocking that Goldman Sachs strategists actually came out with a note saying clients were asking them if China had become uninvestable. Well, has it? We'll get into it with a chief investment officer who's currently in China. But first, Charlie Pellett, tell us who this week's mystery co-host is.
This week's mystery co-host is Yi Shi. Yi is a markets reporter at Bloomberg and was a Go chess champion as a kid in his hometown of Wuxi, China. Since moving to the U.S. 16 years ago, he's become a Seinfeld fanatic and still listens to reruns on his iPhone every night to help him understand close talkers like Regan.
Yi. I, too, am a Seinfeld fanatic, as you know. If Bloomberg were Seinfeld, I'm thinking I'm probably the Kramer character. I don't know. Hopefully not the Newman character. What do you think?
Yeah. My favorite is George Costanza.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think he's everyone's favorite. And you also have me intrigued with Go Chess. You're going to have to teach me how to play that sometime.
Right. It's like one of the most ancient chess game, very popular in China, South Korea, and Japan. And I just taught myself at age of probably 5, 6, and just really obsessed with playing it. But I won the champion in the city when I was in middle school, but I stopped playing in high school because I'm so busy with the study. So I'm sympathetic about the crackdown of the cramp schools. I'm sure we'll talk about on the show.
That's a good segue into our guest here and what's going on in China, the cram schools. And let's bring in our guest. He has really had quite a resume in the financial industry and the investing industry. He's one of the co-founders of Research Affiliates. And more recently, he's the founder and chief investment officer of Irelliant Global Advisors. His name is Jason Su. Jason, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
And Jason, I wanted to get into that idea about the for-profit education industry in China. Now, luckily, I know a little bit about this. I edit Yi every day, so I'm able to read his insights on China, so I know a little bit. But I think for a lot of Americans, this seems like a strange thing for a market sell-off, a crackdown on the education industry. But walk us through, basically, what problem is China trying to solve here with this crackdown on for-profit education? And why such a dramatic impact on the market in China?
Absolutely. So this is a little difficult for, I think, Westerners to understand, because cram school, the for-profit educational sector, is something very foreign to Westerners, but it's a part of the Asian culture, not just Chinese, but really, I think it is just a part of, the Korean, the Japanese, the Chinese culture. Essentially, cram schools offer you additional after-school tutoring, and it often occurs in a form of sort of regurgitation, memorization of a vast test bank of questions that are likely to be on the next national entrance exam, right? In Asia, gaining admissions into the top high schools and eventually from there, the top universities, requires one scoring at the top of the list on a national entrance exam. So most students spend all of their days essentially preparing for that big exam. And the easiest way to get a high score is not by doing well in school, not by just by understanding the actual knowledge. The easiest way to gain admissions is to practice test exams over and over and over and over again. And if you pay to go to one of the more premium tutoring programs, you'll just have access to the latest test banks. You have access to experts who may have greater ability to predict what's going to be on the exams, and thereby gaining enormous advantage. And so in Asia, it's a very expensive exercise to go to these cram schools. They're costly, they're expensive, but it's also in terms of the hours that children commit to additional memorization and studying. I think this has become such a social problem. If you cite the number one reason for teens committing suicide, it's because of the unbearable hours that they have to commit to this. And also for a lot of parents, it's very expensive and it feels very unfair because the premium programs that give you the highest chance of scoring high on the national exams are quite expensive. So it's broadly understood and viewed as a social problem. Taiwan has tried to fix that. I think Japan has tried to fix that. Again, as I mentioned, the high suicide rate is really a problem. And I guess China has come down with its own way to fix the problem by essentially making these cram schools nonprofit and hopefully taking them out of the equation.
Yeah. And there were a pretty big chunk of equity involved in this, I guess. These companies have grown so large because of all this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the for-profit cram schools are incredibly profitable. They're massive. I mean, there was a point in time in China that the for-profit educational sector is viewed as the most important consumption demand, right? Like people would stop paying rent. They would stop eating just so they could keep paying for cram schools for their kids. And so, it was viewed by investors as one of the, probably safest industry to invest in.
The joke in China is that people asking why crackdown education companies or the cram schools will bring down the whole market. And the joke was that think about this way. If there's 10 birds on a tree, you shoot down one. How many birds are left on the tree? So I thought this is a good analogy to explain the fear people are worried about who's the next target. As you mentioned, Jason, that for a lot of like foreign observers or investors, they don't quite understand Chinese policies. It seems quite random, ad hoc in terms of policies and regulation changes. If we think about it, it started with Ant Group in November when China put down their listing at the last minute. Then we started to have government targeting Alibaba, Tencent, all these big internet companies for their monolith behavior. Then we have the Didi. The government banned their app soon after their IPO in the U.S., Now we have the education companies. Is any coherent logic of all of these government actions? Is any ultimate goal China is trying to achieve?
Absolutely. I think the best analogy, and hopefully one I think the West would be more sympathetic to, is the Chinese regulators. They see themselves as part of the global ESG trend, right? Part of it is saying that, look, the free market doesn't solve all problems. So you can't just leave problems, especially social ones, to the free market. Very much, in line with the ESG, I think, philosophy, which is you need regulators, you need socially minded individuals, investors to sort of come and undo some of the excesses, some of the negative externalities of free market competition. And so I think the Chinese regulators very much have been looking at, what are the problems that the perhaps, profit maximization has created that they think need fixing, that society can't tolerate anymore. So if you take the educational sector, I think, as I mentioned, that's been a social problem that a lot of Asian regulators, a lot of Asian economies have been trying to fix. But if you even look back further, right, in the recent month, yes, you mentioned whether it is cracking down on some of the big consumer tech where the monopoly power has made both work conditions very, very bad for laborers and also made it uncompetitive for smaller businesses to get in. For example, Meituan, their share price also took a beating when the regulator announced that it is not acceptable for them to treat all of their employees as contractors and not pay essentially social security for them. So, that's very much something that's been talked about in the U.S., with Uber, with Lyft, where essentially regulators says, look, the businesses are being unfair and not paying their fair share for, you know, what other, you know, for-profit businesses have always paid, which is pay into the Social Security for employees instead of treating them as contractors. So if you look at these issues and understand them, and clearly they're going to be idiosyncratic to each economy and markets, you'll start to be able to predict at least the Chinese regulators' behaviors when it comes to what are the important ESG issues that they're grappling with and they're likely to act on.
You know, Jason, it's one of those times I wish this podcast was on video. I just want to set the scene for listeners here. Jason is appearing to us from what looks like the Starship Enterprise from Star Trek. Absolutely my favorite Zoom background I've seen in a lot of these. I keep expecting you to get a call from Scotty, you know, saying we ain't got no power, Captain, or something. But Jason wins the best Zoom background of in what goes up history. I'm going to say it here right now. But Jason, in that intro, I mentioned that note from Goldman that was out this week saying, you know, their clients are calling them up saying, is China uninvestable right now? And I know you're managing a active ETF with Chinese stocks, so I'm assuming your answer is, oh, I hope not, at least, you know. But but given this sort of, you know, regulatory risk that we're talking about, how would you answer that question? You know, you sort of hinted at the idea of trying to put your head in the mind of Chinese regulators and get ahead of what might come next. But what is sort of a good industry that in China is a beneficial to society that you don't have to worry about the government sort of turning off overnight like we saw in the education industry?
Well, I would say now that the government has sat down and had a good talking to with the big financial, I guess, with the big fintechs and the consumer techs, and then warn them about wielding monopoly power. I think, you know, for firms that truly have innovated and that have brought products and services that have made things better and easier, certainly benefited the consumers, created large number of jobs. You know, I think governments are generally, you know, globally and certainly in China, supportive of businesses and industries like that. So I would say, you know, broadly, you know, most of the firms that have sold off are probably good buying opportunities today. Just pay attention to those that are likely to be in the crosshair of the regulators, right? So, you know, firms that, you know, continue to wield monopoly powers and don't seem to sort of get the memo with regard to, you know, the government's sort of displeasure with monopoly powers and anti-competitive behaviors. And certainly, you know, I would say industries that traditionally in the West that we're more concerned about, you know, the liquor, the tobacco, those are all likely to be issues as industries that are big polluters that are anti-green and being, you know, given that carbon neutral is now a big initiative for China. So those industries, I think that traditionally are more of the negative or low ESG firms and industries, I think those are the big risks in China. And again, you know, this is partly because, you know, Chinese regulators and then Chinese societies, no different to the Western societies, as they become wealthier and can afford it, they do demand some of the very same sort of ESG issues to be taken care of as we in the West do.
So there's this sort of a perception from the investors, especially after the recent events, that it looks like the Chinese has become anti-capital now. They are moving backwards. At least there's a perception there. I guess that's why Goldman had fielded so many calls from their clients, whether China is investable or not. It looks like there should be a China discount because people don't understand the rule anymore. People don't understand the boundaries anymore. I saw this article from Stephen Roach, his long-term China bull. He said he's been optimistic about China for the last 25 years. Now he start to doubt whether this is a moment he should have a second thought. So do you think that China is doing the right thing?
Well, I think, you know, execution can always be better. I think you know, a lot more pre-communication, being a lot more clear about what the regulators want to accomplish, being much more, I would say, transparent with regard to the sort of ESG agenda, especially, I would say, you know, carbon neutrality would be a good one. You know, China's been signaling that, signaling its path toward green. And I think that's helped out the market a lot in terms of understanding where to direct capital, what to expect. If China sort of shares that same kind of transparency with regard to perhaps more of the negative ESG issues, that would help the market out a bit as well. And certainly, I think the investors got to do the other half, right? Because actually, it's been in a number of policy speeches given by President Xi going all the way back to late 2018 with regard to his concern about the inequity in the educational field and really the pain created by the cram schools on the children and the parents. So I think investors also have to you know, listen a bit more attentively to sort of some of these policy pre-signaling. But I would say, yes, in terms of execution, it can always be better understanding how markets can lose confidence from even the slightest, I think, surprises coming from regulators, especially when it comes to China and especially in this current environment. So yes, you know, much can be improved upon, but I would say the work goes on both sides, right? Both the regulators in China, but also investors looking to invest in China, because we got to recognize it is a more foreign market. Our access to information is a little bit more challenged versus our access to information when dealing with, say, US, you know, the NYSE. And so investors really do have to work a little harder as well, right? It's not a responsible approach for managers and investors to simply just blame Chinese policymakers in this case.
You know, Jason, you have such a strong background in sort of the academic quantitative approach to investing, you know, at research affiliates and presumably now at this firm. And at risk of repeating a joke I think I've already made on a previous episode of the podcast, but you know, to me, it's like being a quant in the market is sort of taking the, you know, being like in the college classroom approach to markets, where the retail trader has taken over and it's now more like a market that's a fraternity party rather than a classroom setting, you know. And I know in China, it has that reputation for being such a retail driven market. I've seen stats, something like 80, 90%. Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. Something like 80, 90% of volume is China is retail driven and very much a sort of a gambler's ethos rather than a, you know, a buy and hold investor's approach to the market. So I want to ask you a two-part question about that and feel lucky. Sometimes I ask 12-part questions, so a two-part's letting you off easy. But so how does a quant approach China given that type of dominance in the market among the retail set? And secondly, you know, are there lessons to be learned from analyzing that cohort of the Chinese market for what we're now seeing in the U.S., where this growing dominance of retail investors and kind of their unpredictability and their sort of, you know, investing on whims and message boards. You know, I'm guessing momentum probably is a factor that translates regardless. But I'm just curious, you know, as a quant, how do you approach a retail driven market like China? And, you know, are there lessons to apply to the U.S. market as the retail trader sort of takes over?
Oh, absolutely. So first of all, you're absolutely right that China is a retail dominated market. And because of that, there is a very much casino feel to it rather than a long term investment, retirement, investment based feel to that market. The result of which is in the short run, prices can feel random, right? Prices don't seem to rationally respond to either news or sort of changes and developments in the fundamentals of companies. Now, that's, of course, not a China-specific issue, right? Any market that's heavily retail, for example, you know, U.S. has gone from 3% retail to now closer to 30% retail with, you know, Robinhood free trading and you know, WallStreetBet.com, you know, type of activities. And you know, in China, it's just, you know, three times the magnitude, right? Because they're closer to 85, 90% instead of 30. So I think as an investor, in the short run, what will help you be successful is actually focusing more on what drives sentiment, right? So be it the news cycle, right? Be it what is capturing the attention of media, of major influencers on blogs and podcasts. Those are probably likely to give you more of an edge trading in that market. So in some ways, think of, short-term signals, betting on short-term momentum, short-term mean reversion, looking at almost, technical pattern type analyses are going to give you an edge more so than looking at long-term fundamentals, understanding industries and firms. And in fact, the most successful investors in China today, are not the stock pickers who understand cash flow discounting, not the quants who understand sort of these long-term factors. I predict earnings growth, but really people who employ technical analysis on a daily basis. I would say more of the high frequency market maker type of investors and strategies. So in that type of market, you simply have to bring into play a lot more of the non-fundamental, more of the sentiment-based analysis to really have short-term success. But I think in the long run, markets always converge and come back to fundamental, and China's no difference. It just means you have to put up with more of the short-term noises.
I want to let you talk your book a little bit here and talk to me about the Raylion Quantamental China ETF. RayQ is the ticker, right? And tell me what
RayC.
Okay, good. That was a test. I'm just making sure you got your tickers right there. So say I'm a guy in the elevator there on the Starship Enterprise with you, and you got 2 minutes to tell me, sell me on this ETF. It's an active ETF. So what's the selling point for it as far as your methodology and how you construct the portfolio compared to, say, the FXI, the index tracking passive ETF that's U.S. investors are pretty familiar with? What's your sales pitch?
Well, if you want to access China, right, you want to access China actively. And that's because a cap-weighted passive index doesn't make sense for a very inefficient market where in the short run, lots of great companies are underpriced and lots of bad companies are overpriced. And where, doing some research is going to give you an edge in terms of knowing what the informed institutions are buying, perhaps knowing what the informed and well-plugged in people who understand policy shifts are buying and doing. So the active approach is certainly going to help you additionally by the low price, good quality firms that will grow and avoid, I think, a lot of the hype, a lot of the stories, a lot of firms that do eventually become regulatory risk, either because of poor governance or because of just general poor compliance with the regulatory environment. So you got to go active in a market that's 85-90% retail traded.
Jason, one of the rationales I heard for the crackdown on the cram schools is China's three-child policy. They want to encourage families to have three children. And obviously, if you have to pay for three sets of cram schools, that's going to get pretty expensive. But I wonder, that's a fascinating concept to me, because here in the U.S., we have a hard time getting people to wear a mask, to stop a virus or get a free vaccination. We have a hard time having the government getting people to do anything. But in China, I wonder, is it harder to get couples to have three kids than to say the one child policy? And how important is that of a policy as far as the economy and how you're thinking about investments? Does it play into it at all, this potential for a sort of a baby boom relative to what China has seen in recent generations?
Okay, so first of all, you're absolutely right. I think it is probably far more difficult today to ask you know, Chinese couples to have kids than to not have kids. And then again, and that's more of an Asian phenomenon today, right? If you look at Taiwan, you look at South Korea, like the birth rate per couple is less than one, right? So that's obviously very bad for demographics, right? That's very bad for looking at consumption growth, you know, 10, 20 years down the road when you have such a, you know, rapidly dropping population.
Kids are expensive. You know, China, kids are very expensive. As a father of three kids, I will tell you,
you met your quota in China.
I met my quota. It's not in compliance.
You've done well. Yeah, and as the kids are very expensive from both a financial resourcing perspective, but also for young couples in China today, right, where there's a lot more, I think, opportunities to make more money, change your quality of life. So you start to think about, hey, you know, I have opportunity cost, right? When I'm raising kids, I'm maybe not out there making money or spending money, given that I'm able to make a lot more money now. So I think what we're seeing is really a issue we see in developed markets, right? You know, as economy evolves, develops, people's willingness or the need to have more children simply have declined. So that's just something I don't think you could mandate easily and change. Now, of course, you know, the government has sort of gone out and tried to research what's stopping young couples from having to, you know, having kids or wanting to have kids. And, you know, the responses, unsurprisingly, have been so expensive to raise kids. Right? Part of it is cram school. Part of it is you know, real estate, right? Because if you want to be in areas that are safer, nicer, better schools, that, you know, real estate is expensive. The government's also been talking about, you know, how to you know, change or, you know, influence real estate prices so that that it's not so expensive for people to have access to good school districts and so on and so forth. But I don't think that'll solve everything, right? These are sort of on the margin issues, but they're not all the totality of the issues. So I think the regulators and then the policymakers in China are going to find it frustrating that they're trying to do so much, but the outputs, the outcomes may not actually be as meaningful as say they're hoping to achieve.
Yeah. Play some romantic music over loudspeakers or something. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see what they do.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Well, with that said, guys, I can't let you go without partaking in our tradition. And Jason, I hope they warned you about this, but we have a tradition here. We end each show with the craziest things we saw in markets during the week. Yi, I have a feeling you got something crazy for us. I want to start with you.
Yes, it's actually related to the three-child policy. So Panzhihua City, which is a city of 1.2 million people in southwest China, Sichuan's province, is giving each couple, each baby actually, essentially 500 yuan, which is $80 a month for families that have second child or third child until the babies turn three. So this is the first China city offer cash for people to have more babies. It's probably pretty standard in the Western countries to have child subsidies, but not long ago, China had one point child policy. And in 2013, it turned into two China policy. Now we have a three child policy and people are offering cash to have people to have more babies. I think that's pretty crazy.
That'll work better than my romantic music idea, I think. You know, that's how you do it, I guess.
Just off of cash, yeah.
How about you, Jason? Have you seen anything crazy in markets this week?
Well, I think the craziest thing I saw was the massive rebound you know, in the educational sector, where essentially, if you read the policy announcement, these firms should be worth pretty darn close to zero.
Right.
But somehow, there's still people who are willing to jump in and catch a falling knife, hoping there is a rebound, right? And so I found that pretty crazy, right? You know, people are not doing their homework.
That is pretty good, yeah. I mean, I wonder, boy, how long it's going to take to sort of, you know, remove the profitability from these companies. That is crazy, though. That, yeah, you're right, though. Why would anyone pay anything for them at this point?
I mean, literally, the regulator says, look, the firm you're buying, we are going to make them into nonprofits, meaning they're not going to pay a dividend, right? They're not allowed to make a profit, but somehow you still want to become a shareholder.
Yeah, that is good. That's a good one. That's a crazy one. All right, well, I'll give you guys mine. I listeners know I like the alternative assets, and the more alternative the asset class, the better. So I bring to an auction that's going to happen next month in Great Britain. They're auctioning off one slice of wedding cake from the wedding of Prince Charles and Princess Diana 40 years ago.
Someone's that's still available?
Yes, yes. Someone saved one piece of wedding cake. I'll just, and I hate to say it to you guys, but you have to play Price is Right with me now here. I'm going to ask you each what you think the expected bid is for this piece of wedding cake. Put those quant skills to work, Jason, and let me know here. It's ice. Came from, there were actually 23, and as far as supply goes, there were 23 official wedding cakes for that wedding, which is pretty amazing. Happened almost 40 years ago, exactly, July 1981. Features a marzipan base and a sugar onlay coat of arms colored in gold, red, blue, and silver on top. It was given to one of the household servants of the Queen Mother, and she kept this thing for all these years. So it hasn't gone on auction yet, so who knows what the actual price will be. But what do you guys think? Two-part question again. Start with you, Yi. What do you think the expected bid is for this in British pounds? And second part is, would you take a taste of this wedding cake?
I was trying to say 10 Bitcoins since we are talking about alternative assets, but we can't do the conversion to the British pounds. No, I won't take a bite on the cake.
Smart man, 10 Bitcoins, that puts it up at close to $40,000, so call it 30,000 British pounds. Jason, how about you? You going over or under that?
I think he said 10 Bitcoins. That makes about 300,000 pounds.
Oh, you're right.
Being from Boston, where I track, you know, Tom Brady's progression, even though he's moved on to a different city now, I know his rookie card fetched something like $1.3 million last time it got auctioned. And it's not the only car left in the world, unlike this piece of wedding cake, right? So I gotta say the wedding cake's gotta fetch something like, let's say, 1.5 million pounds. How's that? and when it's that expensive, I'm not gonna take a bite.
I will say it's Dominic Winter Auctioneers. I imagine they would like both of you two to be bidding in this auction, because the reason I brought this up is the surprising low value they think. They're thinking only 500 pounds. I think it's going to go. We're gonna have to check back on this in August when it actually goes up, right? Because I think it's going to go for a lot more than 500 pounds. I might buy the thing myself. I think they're way off in their expected bid on that. Maybe that's a way to drum up interest and get people bidding on it. But a similar piece of cake sold in 1998, I think, right after Princess Diana died, for like 150,000 pounds.
Wow.
So a depreciating asset. Wedding cakes are a depreciating asset.
The only question I have is, how do they authentic the cake? How do you verify cake from the wedding?
Yep. They it comes with some kind of documentation. I'd have to look up the story, but there is the servant who collected it was given to her, I think, as just leftovers, like, here, you want some cake? And she knew that this might be worth a few bucks, so she tucked it away and she wrote on top of it, wedding cake from Princess Diana. So there's some kind of, these auction houses are good at authenticating this stuff. I'm not sure how, but I it'd be a pretty good scam to have a 40-year-old piece of wedding cake that was not real.
You know, if they somehow turn this into an NFT, it might be worth even more.
Right. An NFT is someone actually eating the thing and then, you know, sell that for you might get your million and a half for that. But we'll see. I'm going to check back because I think you guys were in the right direction. I think it's going to go a lot more than what they expected for it.
Right.
Because people pay crazy money for crazy things that's the lesson of this segment, I think. So, but guys, really enjoyed this conversation. Jason, Sue, and Yishi, thank you both for your time. Jason, I know it's early where you are, so thank you for getting up early for us. And
absolutely.
And get back to the flight deck there of the USS Enterprise.
What Goes Up, we'll be back next week.
Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Yi Shi is at Shi Yi Bloomberg. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pelt of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.